You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. I got some troubles, but they won't last. I'm gonna lay right down here in the grass, and pretty soon all my troubles will pass. Cause I'm in shoo-shoo-shoo, sugar town.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight, I'm gonna your gate and maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made it in some velvet morning when I'm straight.
Flowers growing on a hill, dragonflies and daffodils learn from us very much. Look at us, but do not touch. Phaedra is my.
If you grew up in the 60s like I did, you know there was a beautiful singer who had an incredible amount of hits and was known for her white boots. And teenage boys, we just flocked to her, and I'm one of those boys who did. Joining us right now on the air is the lovely Nancy Sinatra, who still looks great to this day. Hi, Nancy. How are you?
Hi, Mark. What a great introduction. Wow.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Are you doing okay?
Yeah.
Is life good?
Life is wonderful.
Life is good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. The boots thing really kind of took off. Obviously, boots are made for walking became number one, but you still have boots as a symbol for your whole thing, even your website.
Yes. It's the song has a life of its own, and it was a very powerful force for some reason and in a lot of ways in Vietnam and... In Germany, they said that it was a hit because of the war. In France, they said it was a hit because there was a subway strike going on in New York. Everybody had an opinion about that song.
Hmm.
So it was very, very forceful in its own way.
It was kind of like an anthem for women's rights early on.
Yeah, well, I don't think it caught on quite that way until later on, but yes. In retrospect, it really was the first song of its kind.
I mean, before I Am Woman by Helen Reddy, that was around.
Yeah.
You know?
That was in the 70s, I think, wasn't
that
it?
That was. It was in the 70s, yeah. I mean, it's interesting to note that when your career started, as far as I remember, you had a couple of songs out. You didn't have that image. What was it who or what changed that image of yours that made you like the kind of the rebel chick that people liked?
Actually, there were about 30 songs prior to Boots, and we called them Bubblegum. I was being recorded in the style of Annette Funicello, by her arranger-producer, Tutti Camerata. And we had some pretty good hits worldwide. We even had some number one records with that stuff.
Not in the USA, though.
Nothing.
Yeah.
I couldn't even get played on the radio here.
Yeah.
I think I heard one song once, and I went down, I drove down to the station here in L.A., and I got the DJ's autograph. I was so relieved to hear one song after all those years. They were like, I don't know, 4 years of nothing.
So did they try to make you like another Annette Funicello or Shelley Fabre? Then around 66, you changed the whole thing. Was it you that changed the image?
65, actually. I was working with Jimmy Bowen, who was then head of Reprise A&R, Artist and Repertory, and it was his job, really, to place me with somebody. My contract was about up. It was, I was going to be history on the label, even though I had paid my own way pretty much with the European hits. They were about to give up.
Now, so, didn't your dad own the label?
Yeah, but that didn't make any difference.
I guess not. No.
So, you have to pay your own way on a label. You can't get by just being somebody's daughter.
Right.
So Jimmy said he was going to try me with Don Costa, which he did. Same problem. Didn't work. Then Jimmy tried producing me himself. And we came up with a closer feel to what we were about to evolve to with a song called True Love. We did a remake of True Love from High Society, and it had the Phil Spector sound kind of to it. And we were getting closer, but no cigar. So Jimmy was talking to Lee Hazelwood about me, and Lee was on the label producing Dino, Desi, and Billy, and he was also working with Dwayne Eddy and having very good luck with both those acts. And Lee said, if I don't get her on the charts with the first record, you can fire both of us. And we got on the charts with a song called So Long, Babe. And So Long, Babe was the first American chart record I had.
Wow.
It changed everything.
Well, it also that collaboration with Lee obviously did as well.
Yeah, he knew what he wanted me to sound like, and he's a very good engineer. We just recorded again in Nashville. We did an album down there, and it is so good. I'm so proud of it because, I don't know, 30, almost 40 years later, you know, we were skittish, or we were nervous about even trying it because a lot of critics will say, well, they should have stayed in bed or whatever, you know, at their ages. But for me, it was quite a marvelous feat because, as Lee said just recently, we proved that Beauty and the Beast still exist and that the magic is still there. So I'm really, really happy with that.
Yeah, I always thought you guys sounded great together. You know, obviously, there was this chemistry from the beginning.
Yeah, it was. It was the old guy and the young innocent girl, and it worked. Now, of course, we had to do more age-appropriate songs, much more adult kind of music, but it still works.
Now, whose idea was it for the white go-go boots and the miniskirts?
Well, the white boots came from the movie I did with Elvis called Speedway. The original boots were red. They were on the album cover, on the Boots album cover. And they came from Carnaby Street. When So Long Babe came out, I had been to London, did a lot of boots and miniskirt shopping because those things didn't exist here, really.
Right, London, they introduced the miniskirt.
Yeah, so right. I brought them home, started wearing them around town, people started copying it. Then when Boots hit, the album cover, of course, had to be just perfect, and it was. It's kind of an icon now. with the red boots. I have those boots. They're lamps in my office now.
You're kidding.
No.
They should be in the Smithsonian Institute.
Yeah, they're lamps, and they are mounted on the wall, and the harp and the light bulb and the lampshade come up out of the boots, so they're real, real cute.
You know, you mentioned Elvis's Speedway. There were rumors at the time that you and Elvis were an item. I don't know if that was true or not.
I wish.
Elvis
and Priscilla were pregnant with Lisa Marie.
Hmm.
And there are rules about all that.
Well, was there chemistry between you guys?
Absolutely.
Yeah. He was an amazing guy. I mean, how close did you get to him?
Very, very close. We became very good friends. He called me the night Lisa was born. And, I'm just sorry I lost track of him later on when I started having my kids. I sent him pictures of my children, and we talked occasionally, you know, when it was possible, but I think I only saw him once during that time when I was having babies. And then after my second baby was born, just a short time after, they found him dead that morning, and I was just devastated, and I felt really bad that I didn't stay as close as I should have, and maybe I could have, you know how you do.
Sure.
You could have helped him some way, but somebody said to me, you can't play God, so stop it, you know.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I've spoken with his relatives, his best friends, and there was just no way that train was going to stop. Unless it did the way it did it, unfortunately. You know?
Yeah, it's an American tragedy. We were deprived of what was to come.
Did you
have you
heard Lisa Presley's new CD?
I haven't heard it. I can't wait. How is it? Is it good?
It's actually pretty good. I was really happy for her because I think maybe it'll have a little success.
I hope so.
Yeah.
That would be swell.
Yeah.
I know that she waited a long time to do this.
She had interest. That's why one of the reasons why I think she married Michael Jackson. She thought that Michael might be able to help her out. Didn't work out that way. But
no, well, we all make mistakes. You know?
We certainly do. Now, you mentioned you have a couple children?
I have two daughters.
Yeah, either of them in showbiz?
Well, sort of. My younger daughter is a photographer and an artist. She paints beautifully, and she had a sold-out exhibit a couple of years ago, and now she's painting to do another show, and it takes a long time. She's very, very talented, and my other daughter is, my older daughter, AJ, is a singer and a bass player. She had a punk rock band in college and then moved into a kind of a jazz feel most recently. But she's also a music supervisor for films, and she's a graduate of the USC Film School in screenwriting. So she's extremely talented in many areas. She's working right now on a screenplay. Plus, she's putting together an album for her mom to sing because she has a theory about what I should be doing musically that might get me back on the radio. We'll see.
That's interesting. I was going to say, maybe she can come up with a nice duo with her mom.
We actually already did that. We did a song for a band in the UK called Reno. And AJ and her husband, Matt, wrote a song to an existing track, which I had never heard of before. Reno had done a dance track. AJ and Matt put a melody and a lyric to the existing dance track. I came in to their studio in Hoboken when I was there 6 months ago. We put my vocal on. We sent it to Reno. They loved it. It's coming out as a single in the UK.
Wow.
And I have fairly high hopes for it because it's the kind of feeling that I've kind of wanted to capture on record. It's a newer, well, it's very new for me. It's a newer sound, and very techno, and who knows? I mean, Cher did it.
Exactly. I was just thinking, you said that. I think of Believe and stuff. I mean, you know, it's all, mm-hmm. all techno stuff. But, you know, it wouldn't be ironic, though, if a duet with your daughter became a huge hit after the great success that you had with your father, Frank, in Something Stupid.
Yeah, I don't know about irony, but it would certainly come full circle and mean a lot to me and to my daughter. She's on the record as well, singing, so it's you can hardly hear her. She's way up high. She's like an octave higher than I am on the choruses, but it's a real interesting sound.
Yeah. What was that like when you were recorded with Dad? I love that song, by the way, Something Stupid. I actually
Isn't
have
that a great song?
All these songs that we're talking about here are all in, you know, some great, you know, they've been released by Sundazed and by Rhino Head on an original collection. Sundazed has almost the whole catalog out now, which is great. And but all these things I actually have on singles because I went and bought them years ago. Of course, I tell the kids I have singles. They don't know what the hell that means. They say, those are those little CDs that are black or something. But, yeah, I love these songs, but Something Stupid was a wonderful song. It was just
and
you must have enjoyed so much to do that with him and to have such a great success with it.
It was great fun. It was written by a man named Carson Parks, who's the brother of Van Dyke Parks, who has recently been touring with Brian Wilson with the Pet Sounds concerts.
Right.
And they're a very talented family. Carson had the song out on record with, I'm trying to think whether it was his wife or perhaps a sister, I don't know, but anyway, he had it as a duet on a record, and someone who worked for my dad heard the song, thought it was marvelous, and thought it would be good for Frank and Nancy, so he brought it to Dad, who loved it, and he said, send it to Nancy, if she likes it, let's do it. So we stuck it on the end of a session that Dad was doing with Antonio Carlos Jobim. It was interesting because the A-team left the studio, the rhythm section, and the B-team, our wrecking crew, came in, and Jimmy Bowen and Lee Hazelwood co-produced it. It just happened like magic. At the end of a very magical session, because that album my dad did with Joe Beam was brilliant. So it was a real night of music, eclectic music.
Did he get a real big kick out of it to have that song hit to number one?
He said it was going to be number one when he heard the playback.
Really?
Wow. I knew it was going to be a hit as well. The song was just too good not to be a hit.
Yeah, it's just so catchy. You just find yourself singing it and humming it. And,
yeah.
And you guys sound so good together. It's amazing how well that went. We're talking with Nancy Sinatra, and you had a ton of hits. In fact,
that the incest song. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, a lot of the DJs who really were forced to play it because it was number one in the nation for a while nicknamed it the incest song because it was a father and daughter singing a love song.
Well, you know something? I must be a real naive kind of guy because I didn't even think of that.
I know, neither did I, but what the heck.
Yeah, I know. It's just amazing, though. And so the late 60s, you know, that was a big hit. And around that same time, actually, that came out was also That's Life, that album that came out around the next year, 6 months later, something like that.
Uh-huh.
That was a great album as well that your dad did. Was that the same one from that session that you're talking about?
No.
Which album was that?
It was called Francis Albert Sinatra and Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Oh, okay. All right. I remember that one, too. I don't have that one, but I remember it.
You should have it.
Strangers in the Night, I have that one as well. That was the year before, I think.
Uh-huh.
All these are great stuff. I love it. Now, you also did, and we mentioned the Elvis movie. You did a lot of other stuff, too. In fact, I remember the one where you were on a motorcycle. Was it Wild
Angels?
Angels, yeah.
That was a terrible movie, but it was the forerunner to Easy Rider, and Peter always credits it for kicking him into Easy Rider, Peter Fonda.
Did you enjoy working in that movie?
I loved it. We had such a blast. Roger Corman's crews were great. They worked fast. Roger was really, really smart, and prolific. When I think about all of the movies that his company put out, all those AIP movies, they were they spoke for a generation of people. We need those now.
Yeah, you're right.
We need a bunch of those coming out now for this generation of people. But nobody's doing them.
Have you got politically active at all in terms of what's going on in the world?
Politics, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your take on everything that's happening?
At the moment?
Yeah.
I'm not being vocal about this because I feel that it's vital to be supportive at this point in time, no matter how we got there or why. I think we have to hang tough as a team. The United States of America has to stand united and support these people and get them home. These wonderful people, young people who are out there in harm's way. And how many people do you know that would lay their lives down on the line for you? You know?
Yeah, I agree.
We just need to behave as though we're grateful for that and stop the bickering about this. And later, when they get home and Election Day rolls around, if that many of us are unhappy, we'll change the whole picture. But, you know, in the meantime, it's not right. We were out tying yellow ribbons last weekend.
Well, it was really wonderful to see the POWs coming home.
Oh, my God, isn't that fabulous?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very close to Vietnam veterans because that was my war, so to speak. I was there with the USO, and
right.
I saw what happened to those poor guys and how they felt so bad because of what was going on here in this country about the war.
They came home and they were spit on.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
it was very, very bad. It was an ugly, dark time for us as a country. People took it out on them. The guys that actually were there doing the fighting instead of, you know, in the election booth.
Yeah, well, people sometimes confuse the fact that people who are fighting for our country are doing what they're told by their superiors. They're fighting a war that they may not even believe in, but they're there, and they're doing their job. And they shouldn't be blamed for the political decisions that are made that sent them there.
That's right.
You know? Talking about heavy things, let's talk about The Ghost in the Invisible Bikini.
1960. An epic film, if ever there was one.
You got to sing Geronimo in that movie.
Geronimo, that was a good song. I don't remember who wrote that.
I don't remember either, but I liked it, though. It was a kind of a great movie, and, of course, you were wearing hip huggers and a tank top in the movie, so I liked it.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, those were the clothes of the day, that's for sure. Mm.
What was the movie thing? You didn't really continue the movie career that much.
I thought I was lousy, so I thought I better spare the American public.
You stuck with the music, huh?
The two movies were actually I did 7 films, and 2 of them put me in as the top female box office attraction of that particular year, which I thought was absurd. But I have the plaque and the trophy to prove it.
Now, see, if it was nowadays, top box office people get $20 million a picture.
Yeah, I know.
I assume back then they didn't make that much.
I would have stayed in the movie business.
Yeah, there's an interesting site on the Internet. I love trolling through the Internet, and there's a site called Swingin' Chicks of the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And you have a big feature on there.
Yeah, there's a book, too. I'm in that book. I didn't appreciate much the guy's attitude, but...
Really?
I guess if you're thought of it all, it's a nice thing, you know?
Well, it seems to me that he's, the stuff that's written in here is fairly respectful, so that's good. You should have respect. You know, it's interesting to note, though, again, let's talk a little bit about something we haven't really talked about. I mean, I know you did a collaboration with your dad. You were on his label. But, I mean, you know, Frank Sinatra was one of the biggest names in music ever and continues to be an icon for Americans. How difficult was it to be his daughter?
Not at all.
No?
Uh-uh.
I mean, I spoke with your brother. I had Frank Jr. on.
That's different.
A few years ago. And, yeah, it was difficult for him.
Yeah, that's different. Because he was a junior. He was Frank Sinatra Jr. Very tough. Plus, he didn't listen to Dad's advice, which was, stay away from what I do. When he realized his kids were going into music, that's what he said. He told me that specifically. He said, don't go into what I do. And, of course, I had grown up with that. And I also studied classical music for 12 years, and I was very much into Elvis and the Everly Brothers and people like that when I was a kid. And I loved the black girl singers, like Laverne Baker and Ruth Brown and those people, because they were doing the double entendre kind of music, which was my generation's music at that point.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing in the late 50s and early 60s a dance called the Dirty Boogie, and we would do it to those wonderful R&B records, which, of course, later on, or during that time, actually, Phil Spector started to capitalize on. And he developed that music into something much greater than it was even then. And I think that's why I eventually had to get into that kind of music, because it was my music. But what my dad said was, stay away from what I do. So I took that advice, went out like Anna Funicello, and ended up, which, you know, they used to tease me that I was Nancy Nice Lady, and went from Nancy Nice Lady to Nasty Jones, which is what Lee Hazlewood named me, because he said that my records would have been hits if my name had been Nasty Jones and not Nancy Sinatra.
I think that he's absolutely correct.
Well, yeah, I think so. And when people still, to this day, believe it or not, people not only compare me to my father, but they say that I only had hit records because of my father,
well,
which is an absolute asinine thing to say.
Well, anybody that says that obviously doesn't know music.
So it shows their stupidity, because you can't do that. The American public isn't that stupid.
No, I mean, you know, sometimes you can get some help, but in your case, the songs that you did wouldn't have been number one by anybody if they were sung the same way you sang them.
Well, that's what I said.
Yeah, there's no question about that.
You know, I got very lucky with Boots. I ran into a hit song and a hit team, a great arranger, Billy Strange, with whom I just worked again in Nashville, a great producer slash engineer, Lee Hazlewood. And I have to tell you, when we were in Nashville recently, I was not happy with what was going on over the weeks that we were recording, because it was all digital, and I didn't like the sound that was coming out. And Billy and Lee said, "Don't worry. By the time we, you know, it will fix." That's an old cliche. Like, trust me, is we'll fix it in the mix. So I just kept hearing, "We'll fix it in the mix," until I was blue in the face, and I just got more and more concerned, because it was getting worse and worse as time went on, and we added layer and layer and layer with horns and strings and vocals and stuff.
Yeah.
And then they did, they fixed it in the mix, and I was not only delighted, but I was very relieved, because I was deeply concerned.
Mm.
I still feel that you should record analog and then move over to digital, so you've got the air and the ambiance of the room in the recordings, but we didn't do that this time. It turned out fine.
That's the bottom line, though, right?
Yeah, but anyway, those hits in those days could have been sung. Oh, no, you know what? As I'm saying these words to you, I'm realizing that's not true, because Lee did some of those songs with Susie Jane Hokum, and they didn't get anywhere. So I guess it was the chemistry.
It was the way you got your voices melded. I mean, Summer Wine and Some Velvet Morning, Jackson, they sound great together. Velvet Morning, people keep emailing me here when they found out you were coming on there. They want to know if you know who Phaedra is.
Phaedra is like a muse of some sort for Lee. It was just a made-up person.
I figured that, but I think it's funny that it generated so many so much interest.
Yeah, you have to remember there was the drug culture was going on then. A lot of that stuff was happening, and hippies and flower children. I'm sorry. And you have to keep that in mind.
Hmm. Did you ever get caught up in that culture at all?
Did I get?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. You escaped it.
But you have to keep that in mind when you listen to a lot of the music from those days.
Yeah.
Lee's Some Velvet Morning and Sugartown were very much drug-related.
Sugartown especially. I know what that was about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
LSD. But Some Velvet Morning was almost like a trip.
Hmm. You know, I want to go through some of the emails because we've got tons of people who want to ask you questions.
But by the way, listen. Yeah. By the way, Phaedra is the name of Lee's granddaughter now.
Isn't that interesting, huh?
So she's marked forever.
Wow.
And I get a lot of, speaking of emails, I get a lot of people on the website who tell me that they were named Phaedra because of that song.
Huh. That's interesting. And the website is nancysinatra.com.
Right.
Folks wanted to know about, first of all, I got to tell you, I remember your Playboy effort in 1995. It was beautiful. I'm sure you were very pleased with the photos.
Those people are artists, you know. I highly recommend it for anyone who's interested in it and who's qualified and physically qualified, because it is, it's an experience of a lifetime. They pamper you. The makeup is gorgeous. The hair is gorgeous. The lighting is perfect. They don't need to retouch a lot because the lighting is so exquisitely beautiful. And I needed that publicity badly because I was trying to get back into the music business.
Mm.
I needed a real publicity stunt.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, you really never left the music business if you think about it. I mean, in people's minds and hearts, you're still there. You know,
Very kind, and you're obviously a fan, but that's not entirely true. But
well, the stuff, I mean, there's quote-unquote oldies radio is still playing this stuff over and over again to
a
new generation.
No, you know what they play? They play Boots. Maybe something stupid. They have really destroyed a lot of people's careers. The body of work, I must have 500 songs recorded, and the whole body of work has virtually disappeared. The albums that are out there on Sundays don't even scratch the surface of what my work has involved over the years, and it's very depressing. And not just for me; it's a lot of great bands and solo artists have just been diminished to one or two songs, you know. And I suppose I should be grateful that they still play Boots, but there's so much more than that.
There is, but you know something, the good part about things, and I agree with you, because of all the consolidation in the radio business, they only play certain songs now, and it really is not right. But the other thing is that the Internet's been developed, and there is tons of interest in the Internet on you. And if you do a search on the Internet on Nancy Sinatra, there are tons and tons and tons of fan sites, and people still listening to your music, and still buying the compilations from Sundays and other companies, and I'm sure they'll buy you new stuff when it comes out as well.
Well, let me give you an example. We put out an album called California Girl. We put it out on the Buena Vista label, and we did that last year. Disney is the Buena Vista company.
Right.
They, by contract, were not obligated to do any promotion of any sort, to put up any money for it. So that's what killed it. But, you know, because of my website and our family website, SinatraFamily.com, I was able to promote it that way. There are about 2,000 people who are absolutely loyal fans, and they bought that, and that's it.
Hmm.
So when you think of it that way, that's not enough to support a record career. And,
no.
You know, I sound like I'm contradicting you, and I appreciate what you're saying in theory, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't necessarily work. The new album with Lee, I think, has a better shot, and I think we're going to go with a British label, because in Europe, they don't care about age. All they care about is the quality of the music, which I think is really wonderful, because it gives people like me and Lee a chance to be heard again. There are a lot of Nancy and Lee fans out there, and if we can't get it promoted so that they hear about this thing, it's going to die. Mm. So like California Girl died. So the key is the promotion.
Yeah, I actually tried to get a copy of California Girl so I could put a couple of little pieces of it on the web and get people interested to go buy it. But I never got a copy of it, so the distribution wasn't very good either.
No, it was not. And that's Disney. So, you know, yeah. how do you get a label to pay attention?
I mean, Disney spends tons
if you're
of money.
Not Britney Spears.
I mean, they're promoting, Hilary Duff, the Lizzie McGuire person, her CD, like mad. So, but I guess you're right about that in terms of, I've heard that from a number of artists from the 60s, that the same thing's happening. But there is so much, people like myself, and there's a lot of us, you know, the big boomer generation still around, and still will go and buy things like that if they know about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Well.
Okay, you were talking about people's emails.
Yeah, actually, I completely lost it.
I took you off track.
That's okay. It's not a problem. I wanted to talk to you about the House of Blues. I understand you're coming down to the House of Blues in Boston.
Yeah, isn't that fun?
When is that coming up?
It's, when is it? It's May what? Oh, let me get my calendar up here. It's May 11th, I think, or 12th.
And that's in Cambridge, Mass. At the House of Blues. Are you doing other House of Blues as well?
No, I would love to do a House of Blues tour. Those clubs are really great.
They are great.
Perfect size for my band. I have a great band, you know. If I do say so myself, I call them the KAB, which stands for. Well, we'll let your listeners figure out what it stands for, because I don't know if I should say it on this.
You can say whatever you want. Go ahead.
I can.
Yeah.
Stands for Kick-Ass Band.
Oh, that's fine. That's harmless. You should hear some of the things that have been said on this show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Kick-Ass Band, huh? That sounds like a good band.
Yeah, Cambridge is the 13th. We travel on the 12th.
Okay, so it's May 13th.
May 13th.
And what other ones do you have coming up, too, we can mention?
We go to Hoboken. Well, before that, we're doing the Hoboken Fair, the street fair, on May 4th, which will be great fun, and I'm looking forward to that. That's a big free day there.
Now, aren't you from New Jersey originally, too?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so it'd be like coming home, huh?
Uh-huh. And then on the 10th back here in Hollywood, we're doing a big USO show for the troops that are stationed around this area. So that should be fun, too. And then we start on tour with Cambridge on the 13th, and then we go back to Hoboken to a club called Maxwell's on the 15th. And the 16th, we dedicate a post office, the post office in Hoboken, to my father, which will be great fun.
Wow.
Then we play a club there in New Jersey called the Surf Club in a beach community called Ortley Beach on the 16th, the night of that. It's going to be a big celebration. And then the 17th, we're in Washington, D.C. at a club called the 930 Club.
You're doing a lot of traveling.
Yeah, the 18th we play Lagoon in Pennsylvania, just a little bit away from the Philadelphia airport. And
hello, and it's me.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
What?
Who was that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
What are you doing, Bill? That's my assistant, Bill, in the office. I have no clue what he's up to. Sorry about that.
That's very nice. Hi, Bill. Well, Bill just made an appearance on the show.
He did?
It's a cameo.
What a dodo.
Well,
sorry.
So, basically, for folks listening in Boston, May 13th, they'll be at the House of Blues and all over the place. Now, I assume NancySinatra.com has the dates on it?
Yes, indeed. There's a calendar there.
Yeah. So this is. I hope that the tour goes really well and that... you never know, but the Lee Hazlewood thing, maybe it'll become a big chart topper and everybody will go out and buy all the stuff again.
Wouldn't that be fun?
It would be fun. I think it would be fun, and it would also be good. I got to ask before I go, because I haven't talked to Frank Jr. for a couple of years, but I know he's been doing pretty well as a band leader, and I've watched him a couple of times lately, and he's sounding really good.
Yeah, well, he's always been a really good singer. He has an amazing range.
Yeah,
he's very powerful. He rarely, I think in all the years, and he's been doing it for four, almost 40 years. In all the years he's been doing it, I've only heard him hit like a couple of bad notes, and they weren't even bad. They were just a little shaky.
Yeah, he's an excellent singer. It's kind of a sad that he had that name, because I think that if he had a different one, maybe he would have gone in a different direction. But on the other hand, I'm sure he's quite proud to have that name.
Yeah, he's now keeping that music alive and helping to keep the flame. That's why we're both out there, too, is to keep this flame going.
Yeah, but the flame
can't
is...
Can't let the music die.
Yeah, well, of course, his music is very close to what your father was doing. Yours is not.
Well, he's doing Sinatra on Sinatra
right
now.
Exactly. So your stuff is completely different. It's your stuff. It's Nancy Sinatra stuff.
Yeah, mine is... I'm more rock and roll now. I've got Clem Burke, who's Blondie's drummer, and Gilby Clark, who was with Guns N' Roses. I still have Don Randy of the original Wrecking Crew, and a couple of other really good players. So it's a nice band, and we're doing some pretty straight-ahead rock and roll. So
does it seem like it's been 40 years since you've been out there touring and stuff? And
but hasn't time just zoomed by? I mean,
it does.
Hasn't even this year just gone so fast?
I mean, you know something? I just had my 30th high school reunion, and I just can't believe that it flew by so quickly, you know?
So you went, huh?
I did. I actually, it was the first reunion I've ever been to. I never went to a reunion before, but I went this year, and I was happy I did. It was, you know, interesting. I think that most people, though, if you have a really good friend in high school or two, you keep in touch with them anyway. It's the people that you never even cared about that you see at the reunion, for the most part. I don't want to say that because now they're all going to complain to me. But don't you feel that? Have you been to any of your reunions?
I didn't go initially because always on the damn reunion committee was that creep Barry Keenan who kidnapped my brother, who was in my same class at school. And so I did not go to them. But then a couple of years ago, actually I didn't even go to the reunion a couple of years ago.
No.
I had a separate one at my house for some of my close friends instead, because I just cannot bring myself to be in the same room with that jerk. Now he's making money off of this case, you know. It makes me so mad.
Doesn't that get you sick?
It makes me ill.
Yeah. It makes me ill, too, when criminals profit off their bad behavior. That guy was a... Yeah, the whole thing was an insane thing that I'm sure that you remember the whole thing like it was yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Unbelievable. I don't even want to get into it because it's nothing worth discussing. But anyway...
No, it's so bad that the California State Supreme Court virtually overturned the Son of Sam law, which states that if you commit a crime, you can't make money off of it.
Right.
And California court didn't agree with that.
How could they not agree with that?
I mean, don't know.
You know, obviously the California court hasn't had any personal experience with crime.
I don't know.
Because if one of the people in their family was damaged by a criminal, you can bet your rear end they wouldn't be wanting those people profiting off it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's annoying. But that's why you got to get involved politically, though. See, you got to get politically active to prevent that.
Well, I am. I am very politically involved. I just don't want to state it right now.
Hmm. I mean, even things like that. I mean, that's something that you can get involved with to you know, get public support to overturn that in the legislature.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Anyway, we look forward to seeing you in Boston on May 13th at the House of Blues in Cambridge, Mass.
Well, I hope you get there. If you do, I'd like to see your face.
Well, you don't want to see that. I look much better on the radio. But if I get there, I will definitely make sure I get introduced.
Yeah, make sure I know you're there.
Okay. All right. You take care of yourself.
You too. Thanks so much.
It was wonderful talking to you.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye.